Good afternoon. Thank you for attending session 331, Joseph Smith's teachings about priesthood, temple, and women. Before we begin, we ask that you turn off your cell phones, and please be respectful and attentive, and when we have questions at the end, please don't be rude to anybody. I'm not going to read all this because you've heard it all before. The session is being recorded, and for that reason, please come up to the microphone during the Q&A so that everything can get on the recording. The session is 60 minutes long, and at the end, unless you're staying for something else, we ask. Well, there is kind of a session afterwards. They're doing book signing and some things, so please clear out so that the next session can start. In October of 2015, the church released its essay, Joseph Smith's Teachings About Priesthood, Temple, and Women. This panel explores early teachings about these concepts, including the anointed quorum and their implications for LDS women today. The presenters are going to speak in the following order. Claire Barris will speak first. He has presented at MHA, Sunstone, Mormon Media Studies Symposiums. His topics include Mormon history, Old Testament studies, and contemporary issues affecting the LDS Church. Our second speaker will be Nancy Ross. She's an assistant professor of art history at Dixie State University in St. George. She received her PhD from the University of Cambridge in 2007 and moonlights as a sociologist of religion. Brenda Roberts will get the last word. She's a member of the Ordained Women Executive Board. In fact, she's the head of Ordained Women. And is an adult convert to the LDS Church from the Black Baptist faith. She is an attorney and has her own law firm, Jenkins and Roberts LLC, where her law partner is her ex-husband, who happens also to be her best friend. I'll turn the time over to Claire.
Nadine asked to be nice and watch your language, and I'd ask if you need to smoke, could you go out in the foyer and smoke, please? Okay, let me give a little context to the essays. A Q&A with former LDS church historian Marlon K. Jensen was hosted by the John A. Widstow Association for Mormon Studies at Utah State University on November 11, 2011. Elder Jensen was asked if church leaders were aware that Mormons were leaving in droves, which Jensen confirmed. He elaborated that, quote, maybe since Kirtland, we've never had a period of, I'll call it, apostasy, like we're having right now, end quote. An interview with Elder Jensen and others was published in an article by the Salt Lake Tribune on January 30th, noting that the church has a, quote, strategy to get church history onto the web, end quote, and that the church is working on an initiative to answer some of those more pressing questions. A little over a year and a half later, in November 2013, the church began releasing a series of essays covering the most common controversial topics discussed in the Latter-day Saint community. In October of 2015, two of those essays were released discussing women's issues, one about Mother in Heaven and the other on women and the priesthood. I'll be discussing the essay titled Joseph Smith's Teachings About Priesthood, Temple, and Women. The stated purpose of the essay is to help answer questions that have arisen about women's standing in the church by providing Joseph Smith's teachings on women and priesthood authority. The essay opens a new direction for church discourse regarding women and priesthood. It states that Joseph Smith, quote, taught men and women that by receiving temple ordinances culminating in the sealing ordinance, they entered into an order of the priesthood, end quote. This statement clearly states that women have priesthood. Additional territory is opened in the essay by underscoring Joseph Smith's, quote, endorsement of women's participation in giving blessings of healing, end quote. This has other potential openings for the way for female blessings in the modern church. In my opinion, the essay marks an important point in the modern history of the church in understanding the potentially, understanding and potentially redefining women's roles. I will proceed with commentary and analysis, providing further historical context and room for additional interpretation. But keep in mind that any critique I make should not lessen my overall positive view of the essay, which corrects the historical record and updates our modern understanding while opening up exciting new ways for LDS women to view themselves and their relationship to the priesthood. Also exciting is the possibility of change in church policy that could expand female spiritual practice and authority. I'll discuss women and the priesthood, but due to time constraints, I won't be talking about female blessings. Elect Lady. The essay begins by describing that what women can do in the church without being ordained to the priesthood, and notes that, quote, early revelations authorized women to expound the scriptures and exhort the church, end quote. The footnote to this points to a verse in the Doctrine and Covenants received shortly after the church was organized, calling Emma an elect lady, who was to be, quote, ordained, unquote, by Joseph Smith to expound and exhort. This is in section 25. Two other female religious leaders in the state of New York also had the title of elect lady. Religious reformers Jemima Wilkinson of the Universal Friends, which we call the Quakers, who lived just 35 miles from Palmyra, and Anne Lee of the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Appearing, which we call the Shakers, both expounded and exhorted to their followers and were called elect ladies. It is unknown if Joseph Smith envisioned Emma in a similar role in the newly formed church. The essay points out that Joseph Smith and Emma's elect lady role was realized 12 years later after the 1830 revelation at the 1842 founding of the Relief Society because she was, quote, elected to be its president. And I think there's a lot that could be said about Joseph's later retro interpretation of what an elect lady meant, that Emma, because she was elected, that made her the elect lady. I think the original intent may have been a little deeper than that. The essay says that, quote, Joseph Smith organized the Relief Society as part of the structure of the church to prepare the saints to participate in the ordinances of the temple, which were introduced soon after the founding of the Relief Society, end quote. With Masonic terminology, the meetings held in a Masonic lodge and Masonic concepts infused in the early minutes of the Relief Society, as well as a strong relationship between the endowment and Freemasonic rituals, it is apparent that Masonry was influential to Joseph Smith when organizing both the Relief Society and the endowment. With this context in mind, it is important to point out that the term elect lady was the title of a French Masonic degree that had admitted women since 1774, whose ritual was first published just 63 miles from Manchester, New York, in 1829. This adoptive ritual focused on the story of Adam and Eve, the fall, and their eventual return to God's presence. The second degree of the ritual recounted stories of Eve's temptation in the Garden of Eden with an apple plucked and presented by a figure representing Satan. The room has a painting of the Garden of Eden. The sister is veiled and is called the Elected Lady. She is anointed on the lips, is presented an apple, and told, quote, you will become as one of us, end quote. This and other Masonic aspects of both temple endowment and the Relief Society are not discussed in the essay. Suffice it to say, Freemasonry shows up repeatedly in the early Relief Society minutes and suggests that Joseph Smith saw a close relationship between the Relief Society and the temple. The essay continues stating, quote, at the time of his death, the revelatory vision imparted to Joseph Smith was securely in place, end quote. This is debatable. As Joseph Smith's life was very hectic after his organization of the Relief Society and introduction of the endowment. The Relief Society ceased to function when the Saints went west and wasn't formally organized for over 20 years until 1867. The shared aspects of the early Relief Society, priesthood, masonry, and temple suggest there would be more involvement of the Relief Society in the temple and priesthood. Today, the original Masonic aspects of the Relief Society are no longer apparent. The essay discusses the interpretation of several statements by Joseph Smith to the Relief Society about priesthood, with a caveat that these statements were about the temple, whose, quote, ordinances were priesthood ordinances, but did not bestow ecclesiastical office on men or women, close quote. It suggests the meaning of some phrases used by him in the original minutes of the Relief Society are different than the meaning they may appear to have at first reading. These statements fall into five categories. So I'm going to review each of these five categories that are discussed in the essay. First, granting or delegating Relief Society keys. Second, statements about ordaining women. Third, the society as a kingdom of priests. Fourth, officers who are to preside over the society and priesthood office. Let me discuss each of these and point out how there may be room for a more expansive interpretation on each of these points. First, keys. Joseph Smith declared to the society, quote, I now turn the key to you in the name of God, and this society shall rejoice, and knowledge and intelligence shall flow down from this time. The essay says this statement indicates that he delegated priesthood authority to women in the Relief Society. The church has used an altered version of this quote for the past 160 years, which said, and see how this is different, I now turn the key in your behalf in the name of the Lord. And the church has just begun to use the correct original statement. The church has historically resisted statements that tie priesthood to women. For example, in April 1994, General Authority Lawrence E. Dunn ordered the removal of Joseph Smith's statement regarding the priestly role of women from a church display commemorating the foundation of the Relief Society. The church is to be commended for correcting the phrase about keys to its original form in this essay and being open about discussing women and the priesthood. The alteration to the statement was done to make it appear that Joseph Smith was operating the keys for the society, while the original has him giving the keys to the society. All right, second point, ordination. The key states, the essay states, quote, President John Taylor, who also acted by assignment from Joseph Smith to, quote, ordain and set apart, unquote, Emma and her counselors, explained in 1880 that the ordination did not give any meaning the conferring of the priesthood upon these sisters. That's a statement from the essay. John Taylor saying it didn't mean ordination. But Joseph Smith's instructions for that day, just before John Taylor, quote, ordained and set apart, close quote, the presidency of the Relief Society, includes the statement that, quote, if any officers are wanted to carry out the design and institution, let them be appointed and set apart as deacons and teachers, etc. The suggested appointment of deacons, teachers, and other priesthood offices, as indicated by the etc., should be taken into account regarding John Taylor's recollection about priesthood ordinances. Joseph Smith, about ordination. Joseph Smith's plan for the Relief Society, as well as the endowment, were in their initial stages and were just beginning to be developed. Caution must be exercised about Taylor's recollection of events 38 years after the fact, as well as Joseph Smith's plans after the initial organization of the society. The essay makes the point that, quote, Mormons sometimes use the term ordain in a broad sense, often interchangeably with set apart, and not always referring to priesthood office. This argument implies that ordain may simply mean set apart in a non-priesthood sense. However, the interchangeability of these two terms works in both directions. Set apart was sometimes used to confer priesthood office without the term ordained. For example, several church presidents were never ordained to their office, but were instead set apart. This includes Lorenzo Snow, Heber J. Grant, and George Albert Smith. The essay argues that, quote, neither Joseph Smith nor any of the persons acting on his behalf nor any of his successors conferred the Aaronic or Melchizedek priesthood on women or ordained women to priesthood office, end quote. However, this doesn't appear to be the case. Over a year and a half after the Relief Society was organized, the minutes of the Quorum of Anointed stated that Emma and Joseph Smith were, quote, ordained to the highest and holiest order of the priesthood, end quote. This quorum is where the endowment and other temple rites were originally practiced. This explicitly states that Emma was ordained to the, quote, highest and holiest order of the priesthood, end quote. So what is this order of the priesthood? References in LDS scripture to the term holy order point to the topical guide entry for Melchizedek priesthood. Alma 13:18 says, Melchizedek, quote, received the office of high priesthood according to the holy order of God, end quote. Emma's ordination to the highest and holiest order of the priesthood appears to be the highest echelons of the Melchizedek priesthood. This brings up another issue not discussed in the essay, that of a priesthood quorum with women. The Quorum of Anointed did more than temple work. They met every other Sunday to transact quorum business. Women participated in important quorum matters, such as petitioning Congress for relief and authorizing an official church proclamation that has the same weight as today's proclamation on the family. Next point, Kingdom of Priests. The essay states, quote, this is a somewhat lengthy quote, Joseph Smith's teachings about temple ordinances provide further context for his priesthood-related teachings to the Relief Society. Joseph spoke of establishing a kingdom of priests. He had used similar terms earlier when speaking of the relationship of all the saints to the temple. This kingdom of priests would be comprised of men and women who made temple covenants, end quote. This argument contains, in my opinion, a leap of logic. Just because Joseph Smith's statement to the Relief Society about becoming a kingdom of priests used similar terminology when speaking of the temple does not mean that the statement was not for the Relief Society. The full statement given to the Relief Society by Joseph Smith gives more context. Quote, the Relief Society should move according to the ancient priesthood. Hence, there should be a select society separate from the evils of the world, choice, virtuous, and holy. Said he was going to make of this society a kingdom of priests, as in Enoch's day, as in Paul's day. End quote. The temple ordinances certainly give priesthood to women. However, Joseph Smith's statement was addressed specifically to the Relief Society. He ties them to the ancient priesthood and specifically stated that the society to whom he was addressing would be a kingdom of priests. Okay, next point, priesthood office. The essay states that when Joseph Smith said that the Relief Society officers would, quote, preside over the society, close quote, it had to do with delegating authority from Joseph Smith to the society. The remainder of the statement suggests their role was similar to the first presidency, with the first presidency acting in an advisory role. Quote, he would ordain them to preside over the society and let them preside just as the presidency preside over the church. And if they need his instruction, ask him, and he will give it from time to time, end quote. The Relief Society did enjoy a relative amount of autonomy for a number of years. However, many of its independent roles are now under priesthood direction. The essay states that, quote, women exercise priesthood authority even though they are not ordained to priesthood office, end quote. In a footnote, Dallin Oaks is quoted as saying, quote, the Lord has directed that only men will be ordained to offices in the priesthood. Presiding authorities are not free to alter this divinely decreed pattern, end quote. Elder Oaks, however, does not provide reference to where the Lord directed that only men should hold priesthood office. Not discussed in the essay are New Testament references to women who had titles of apostle, deaconess, and prophetess, as well as similar Old Testament references. And Joseph Smith, addressing the Relief Society when organizing the presidency, suggested the appointment of deacons, teachers, and others to carry out the designs of the institution. Conclusion. It is important to note that things have changed regarding scholarship on this topic. Some historians who previously wrote on this topic paid a steep price for their publications regarding women having the priesthood. In particular, Maxine Hanks and Michael Quinn were part of the September 6 who were excommunicated or disfellowshipped in 1993 because of writings including an analysis of women and the priesthood in LDS history. Issues raised from recent resurging Mormon feminism have been met largely with accommodation by the church leadership. The exception to this is apparently where the church currently draws the line, at women's ordination. The ordained women movement forced the issue into the limelight, and the church pushed back. Perhaps some of the content of this essay was written in response to the ordained women movement. While the essay goes much further than any other discussion by the modern church about women having priesthood, it appears to draw an interpretive line on several issues. The essay argues that no woman was ever ordained to the Melchizedek priesthood and that women cannot hold priesthood offices, that priesthood keys were not given to the Relief Society, but instead delegated. It says that statements delivered to the Relief Society about ordination and keys were about the temple rather than the society and were meant for men and women in general, and that the word ordain may have meant set apart. Each of these arguments have weaknesses, in my opinion. The essay fails to address issues such as Joseph Smith telling the Relief Society to appoint deacons and teachers and other officers, why New Testament women had titles that sounded like priesthood offices, where the scriptures banned women from priesthood offices, Emma's ordination to the highest order of the Melchizedek priesthood, or why Joseph Smith specifically directed his remarks to, quote, this society, end quote, when discussing ordination, keys, and priesthood. Sometimes quotations from Relief Society minutes omitted text in the essay, that seemed to further emphasize priesthood for the Relief Society. My review of the essay and the historical data upon which it relies suggests there may be other ways to interpret Joseph Smith's teachings on women and priesthood. My reading of the material referenced in the essay suggests Joseph Smith intended women to have a larger priesthood role than defined by the essay. Joseph Smith's intentions for the Relief Society, Temple, and Quorum of Anointed were not completed before his death, which came just two tumultuous years later. It may be that he later redirected his vision of priesthood for women to the Anointed Quorum, where women were involved in quorum business, or that he intended to give Relief Society a larger role in the priesthood after the Quorum of Anointed was organized and the temple completed, but was unable to due to his premature death. Again, I'd like to reemphasize the positive impact of this essay. Despite my critique and proposed alternative interpretations, it breaks new ground in modern LDS discourse by asserting that women have had the priesthood and exercise it in various ways. More work on defining and expanding this concept will no doubt be done by the church, as this pathway is now emphasized rather than being de-emphasized as had previously been the case. Thank you.
So I have a little bit of a different view. But I want to thank Claire for outlining both the essay, its history, and the historical problems with the essay. About 5 years ago, I had a very profound spiritual experience where I came to believe in the ordination of women. And I've since then been writing and speaking, and I've spoken from this pulpit several times to speak about the ordination of women, including several times on behalf of ordained women, where I served as a member of the board for about a year. And of course, Nadine has organized this session, and in the year that I was born, 1980, she first wrote about the ordination of women, and I can't imagine what it would have been like to wrestle with this issue for 35 years, compared to my short five. But I have a very different view of the essay. And in rereading the essay recently, it was hard not to see the essay as the church's lengthy explanation of why we should not ordain women. And I do not doubt that to some readers of the essay, that the essay appears hopeful, and it does change the official church's discourse on the topic of the ordination of women. But again, I felt that I could place the sentence, "We should not ordain women because," in front of each of the paragraphs that were presented in the essay. And I am concerned that the church's approach to women and the priesthood focuses too much on historical issues. And as I think Claire outlined quite succinctly, the church has taken a cafeteria-style approach to historical issues to justify excluding women's ordination. And I know how much the church dislikes cafeteria-style approaches. And so part of me is very concerned that historical issues have become a sideshow, which has become the main show with regard to the issue of women in the priesthood. And I would say, I'm a medieval art historian, but I spent about 5 years ago, I spent a lot of time looking at early Christian art and reading about early Christian theology and reading about the evidence that women were ordained in the early church, not in the early LDS church, but also in early Christianity. And there's extensive evidence for this, you know. And if we happen to believe in the same organization that existed in the primitive church, but can't quite accept that, and have evidence that Emma was ordained, and can't quite accept that, then maybe history is not the place we need to go. We've created historical battlegrounds for women in the priesthood, supposing that we can only really appeal to our history, but can't appeal to our history to justify this thing. And the essay is really position paper about why the LDS Church can't or won't ordain women, which hinges on the meanings of words, where words that have fairly clear meanings, but when are applied to women, do not have the same meanings. And LDS historians and theologians are not the only one to have taken these sorts of arguments. In Gary Macy's book, The Hidden History of Women's Ordination, he also talks about how Catholic theologians, when dealing with same issues in Catholic history, in church history, have also said that, well, when the word ordination has been applied to women, it doesn't actually mean what it says it means something else. So this is not a new trick, and I am not impressed. And so I think we have to stop accepting that the church can reinvent the meanings of words, which have clear meanings, and where the phrase set apart is in fact a synonym of ordain, that we just might have to accept that women were ordained in the past and in the distant past. And that when women were being ordained, they understood that they were being ordained, and that the people who were ordaining them also understood that they were being ordained, whatever John Taylor said years after. And again, I feel like this is a sideshow, because we have mechanisms in our church that are more important than our history. We have this process of continuing revelation. And all we have to do is to get our church leaders, or all our church leaders have to do, is to seek revelation on the topic. But they don't. And they have indicated through the essay that they won't. And so I feel like what God is doing is that God is inspiring women to push for this and circumventing the church hierarchy. Only within Mormonism, ordinary women have no power. And it seems to me like a very impossible situation, because there is no institutional will for this to happen. There is no desire to seek revelation on the topic. And I think that that's what they were trying to say in a roundabout way with the essay. We're not going to do this. We're not really interested in doing this. And so is a woman who is very much interested in this question and to some degree feels called to the priesthood. I don't know what to say. I'm not sure that it's going to happen here. I used to very much believe that it would. And that is a belief and a hope that I have lost. And that is all I'm going to say today. Thank you.
My name is Brenda Roberts, and I am the chair of the Ordained Women Executive Board, and I'm probably coming at it from even a different perspective. But let me tell you a little bit about myself first. My journey in the church has gone from being a golden investigator in 2007 to a convert who was on fire in 2008 and 2009. In 2010, in 2011, and 12, and 13, and 14, to service and the Relief Society presidency, where I gave countless hours of service, to being a Relief Society president, where I gave even more countless hours of service, to someone who loved the temple so much, who loves the temple so much, that I was justified in having 12 different temple dresses, count them, 12, and 6 different temple bags with different packets, different shoes, different everything. I went to the temple just that much, y'all, to now being viewed by my bishop as being unworthy to hold a temple recommend. I received that delightful bit of news in an 81-minute session, which I fondly refer to as spiritual rape, that occurred on July 10th of this year. So for me, it's really real. And the thing that I find almost offensive about this essay is that it tells me, and I'm a lawyer by profession, and one of the rules of statutory construction is that when a word has an ordinary meaning, you don't go out here and make up some new meaning or pretend that it doesn't have an ordinary meaning. So for the church to tell me that when the word ordain was used in referring to Emma Smith and her counselors, that it really didn't mean ordain, it meant some other kind of word, I find that offensive. I also find offensive the notion that the memories of people who were there, and if you're interested in going and reading some of those quotes that we've collected, the memories of the people who were there and who were told the things, those memories are wiped out by subsequent statements by a male. Yes, he was there. But his subsequent statements wipe out everything that was said contemporaneously. And again, If you're talking about interpreting something from a legal standpoint, you will give more weight on what happened contemporaneously than my memory of several years afterwards. But the real reason I get angry about the essay, and I guess not just the essay, I kind of get angry about even focusing on what Joseph Smith taught. As you can see, I'm a black woman. I am 58 years old. I grew up in the South. I know what separate but equal looks like. I know what separate but equal feels like. And I know that separate but equal is a lie from the devil. It is not a thing. So for me, the whole notion that we spend time talking about what may have been intended when what looks like, at least to me, was intended was something that would have still had me as a black woman over here somewhere, not in the middle of doing the work of God, not in the middle of exercising the authority and doing God's work. So I really don't want to talk about that. What I want to talk about is why the church is afraid to grasp the potentiality, to grasp the power of the ninth article of faith, and to look at what needs to be done. I live in a ward, we call it close to the mission field. I live in Atlanta, Georgia. I attend the Atlanta ward. My ward on paper is probably 70% black. The attendance is such that it looks more like maybe 50% black or 60-40. Our ward is extremely large. Our ward needs to be split. Our ward cannot be split because we do not have 40 active Melchizedek priesthood holders to allow us to split that ward. However, we have 50, 60, 70, 80, I would venture to say 90 or 100 women, stalwart women who are there every Sunday, who are doing the work every week, who are out visiting people, who are out ministering to people, but yet we are saying to them that you are not good enough to do this work. That is what troubles me. That is why I am still going to our leaders or attempting to go to our leaders, and that is why, as long as there is breath in my body, I will continue to do this. Because I... Because for me, the importance of Joseph Smith's teachings are that they serve not as a box, but they serve as a springboard. A springboard from which we can use the doctrine of continuing revelation and allow God, notice I said that, allow God to show us what God has in store. I am really convinced that we are not receiving the revelation because we have not shown that we are ready for it. I am really convinced that God is speaking, but we are not hearing. And I don't mean this to be disrespectful to our leaders. I think our leaders are good men, and I think they are trying to do the work of God. But I think they are so behind the blinders of being rich, older, white, heterosexual men from Utah. And I think if they don't see beyond, they cannot see beyond those binders. And what I'm working for, and what I urge you to join with me in working for, is being that constant little gadfly. Just, we will not go away. If they knock some of us away, more of us will come in. We will continue to pester, to annoy, to ask, to show up, to stand in front of the church administrative building, to fill the mailboxes with letters, to fill the emails with emails, to fill all the social media with requests, so that they will hear us, that they will see us, and that they will take this question to God. And my bishop said to me, you know, in my spiritual rape that occurred, he says, well, what if God says no? And I said to him, well, Bishop, the God that I serve will not say no. The God that I serve that gave us the Great Commission and told us to go forth and do all of these things, the God that I serve does not want over 50% of the workers to not be allowed to work. So I cannot envision that. That is, for me, not even in the realm of possibility. And maybe I'm bringing some of my Baptist faith that I never quite got over. But in the Baptist church, we believe in naming and claiming. I am naming this. I am claiming this. I am claiming 2042 as the year when this is going to happen. And for that to happen, we have got to get up and we have got to make it happen. Thank you.
I think we should claim something a little earlier than 2042. I'll be 95 then.
But you will still
but
be here.
I will. My mother's 96. You I will still be here.
You will be here.
But I want it to happen sooner. I will now open this up to questions and answers. And once again, please come up to the microphone. And you can direct your answers to an individual or just ask for anybody, however you prefer to do it.
For Nancy Ross, just a very quick comment on the early church's position and evidence for women's ordination. Thank you.
Sorry. Well, we do have an apostle named Junia referenced in the New Testament. There is extensive documentation throughout the early church that women are called things like priests periodically. Women are called things like bishops. And we know that deacons, women deacons, proliferated because they helped out in the ritual of baptism. And so this... And Phoebe is named. And women were essential in the early church. And so this is not... there is, again, I would refer you to things like Gary Macy's The Hidden History of Women's Ordination and the other book whose title is When Women Were Priests. Thank you, Lori. And so, and there is extensive evidence for this. This is not new work. These discussions have been happening since the 60s and 70s within larger Christian history. And so, but largely we have been ignoring that conversation. So that's...
And if I could just speak to that, I think also instead of limiting it to perhaps looking for historical references of when women served as priests, I think we ought to look at the way Jesus Christ viewed women. I'm blown away by the fact that we don't recognize the significance of women being the witnesses to the resurrection, women going out to tell the male apostles. That message, which is so central to our faith, if that was entrusted to someone who looked like me, why are we placing any limits whatsoever?
So one of the comments was made about why is this so hard for the church leadership to really go and explore this issue? And on one hand, there's a part of me that's like, well, I don't know how much they have or haven't. But one of the questions that has often come to me is there's been real big changes, you know, to church, I don't know if we want to say policy or doctrine, but you look at things like blacks receiving the priesthood or, you know, contraception, which was put out there as being this horrible sin and is now, that's been changed. And so we look at these things and we say, well, there are these pretty major things that the church has changed and said, oh, sorry, we were wrong. What I am curious about is why this? Why is this so much harder? Is this harder? Is there something about this that makes it harder? Because there's a part of me that wonders how many of the church leaders are like, if we came out and we changed our minds, we would have to say we were wrong. And would people have less faith in them? I wonder, is this playing into that? But it's often something that I wonder, like what worries would they have about the implications if they were to change their stance? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I'm curious your thoughts.
I think Mormon leaders desperately need to get to the point where they can say, we're sorry, we were wrong. And one place where now maybe they will be pushed to do that is by Carolyn Pearson's new book, because she is pushing for that. And I hope that brings that into the fore. As to why it's so hard for them, I think it's because they're men who grew up in this patriarchal world where men had power and women bowed down to men's power. And I just think that they really, with blacks in the priesthood, they could empathize with black men who didn't have the priesthood. I don't think they cared that much about the fact that black women couldn't go to the church. I don't think they empathized with that, but I think they empathized with the fact that black men couldn't have the priesthood. And then their hand was kind of forced there as well, because in Brazil they couldn't tell who was black. And so that gave them some reasons to decide that men, black men, should have the priesthood, should be ordained. But they didn't apologize. They said, they relied on really a false history to say, well, we always knew this day was the day would come when the Lord would open the priesthood up to black men. When in fact, history tells us that Brigham Young basically said, never until the millennium, maybe. And so they didn't apologize. They never apologize. And I think they don't apologize because if they admit that earlier church leaders were wrong, then we have to acknowledge that current church leaders can be wrong, and they simply are not willing to do that. They're not willing to give up that power. That's my take on it.
And
Go ahead.
I think my take, and maybe I'm being a little less nice here, but my take is that you look at organized religion, most organized religions have been characterized by two things, racism and sexism. So the church has not been operating in a vacuum. In fact, when friends of mine would say, how can you join that church with the, you know, their racist history, I was quick to point out to my friends, all churches, at least here in the United States, had a racist history. And the reason you had different groups, I was never a Southern Baptist. I was a black Baptist, because the Southern Baptists were white. I was a black Baptist. And I think the same thing with sexism. All of the religions have it built in that women are somehow inferior. What troubles me about the church is that one of the things that trouble me about the church is that we seem to not be able to move as quickly to change these things. Why was it 1978 when things changed? Why couldn't we get the hint maybe in the 40s or maybe in the 50s or at least in the 60s? And it worries me that it's going to take us that long to get the hint when it comes to women. Which is why I said 2042.
So I wanted to address the part of the question that said, what would happen if, you know, there were to be change? What would happen? Last year, I participated in the Mormon gender survey group, where we surveyed about 50,000 Mormons. And we asked this question, you know, would you support the church if the prophet were to suddenly announce that we were going to ordain women? And it was something like 70 or 80% of the responses were yes.
They're probably worried about losing that other 20% when, as long as people are going to stay. But the what balances that out is the 20% who are going to leave if they don't do it. Or more.
There's an episode in mid-century Mormon history that I wanted to know if anyone on the panel could speak to when the appointment or calling of Relief Society General President was reduced from a lifetime calling to just a few years or so, and whether that is within this pattern of almost systematically reducing the prominence and authority of women within the correlated church. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it definitely did. And the Relief Society was really co-opted and taken over in about 1970, I believe. Is that right, Levina? Yeah, about 1970. Although, I think that the pattern of having a more short-term Relief Society president for maybe 5 years is one that ought to be adopted at the highest levels of church governance.
I have a footnote that's kind of related about the loss of authority of women, but this is more in the 60s and 70s, or loss of authority of the Relief Society. By the 1960s, all of the Relief Society welfare functions, such as adoptions, assistance to unwed mothers, and Indian student placement, had been assimilated into the general church programs using professional staff members under priesthood direction. In 1970, the Relief Society was no longer allowed to raise their own funds, the First Presidency stating that, quote, the duty of fundraising where it belongs is on the priesthood, close quote. In 1971, the Relief Society magazine was discontinued. In 1975, the last Relief Society conference was held. In 1976, the Relief Society turned over responsibility for their vast wheat reserves to be administered by the General Church Welfare Committee. So that gives you a little slice of the 70s, I guess, was going on.
I think that was part of a pattern that was much more longstanding than that,
yes,
too, in terms of around the turn of the century, around with World War I, when their wheat reserves were taken over, I believe, as well. Isn't that correct? Somebody know that? Yeah. Right. Levina just said the presiding bishop gave the wheat reserves to the government and then apologized to the Relief Society for not consulting them in advance.
Thank you. I have a question that's been rattling around my brain for a couple of years now. 2020 is coming up. That's 100 years from women's emancipation. I would imagine there's going to be a lot of things precipitated come 2020. Do you see 2020... assisting, helping, facilitating, being involved with your effort at all?
Sort of a women's moment, sort of like the Mormon moment before, and so
yes.
We can. Sounds like a good idea.
I think that what we have seen is that as secular efforts to celebrate women and their rights and what we have gained in recent years becomes more prominent, that the church likes to hunker down on gender roles. And I feel like we're in a period of retrenchment that is not going to necessarily lift anytime soon. So my guess is that it may well hurt women in the church.
I appreciate commenting about the whole, let's step away from using history as a means to encourage, justify, or say we need to move forward with this. One of my concerns about the design, because I do want women's ordination, but I don't want it in the sense that now women can step into the priesthood the way it's functioning now, or even the way it functioned in the early years of the church or the early days of Relief Society, because it was still very exclusive. A person could have a great amount of power as to who could participate, even in the ways that women were participating. And my hope is somehow we can move this conversation forward so that it is a new type of involvement in priesthood for everybody, not having women step into the way it functions now or then, And I don't know how that could possibly happen, but that's my hope, is that we can start changing how we talk about priesthood in every way. And then when we are doing that, so that we're talking about priesthood in the way it really is described in Section 121 and everything with none of these boundaries that we give it, automatically it's going to be obvious. This is for everybody. I just have no idea how that conversation can shift. I don't know if there are any ideas.
I think there's a lot of pressure on the church right now to do that. I think the internet has just opened things up so much. They can't suppress discussion anymore. It goes on. And I think that we certainly have some hardliners in the church government, in the highest offices. But I kind of have a sense these days that we've kind of got a split opinion on some of these things. And there's this one group, and they're in power, and they're holding the line. But down underneath, where we can't see it so much, there's a lot of things percolating. I think I've made fun of President Newsroom lots of times. But I do think that a lot of the pressure for change comes from public relations. And so it is true that on the one hand, what Nancy just said, when there's pressure on the church, they hunker down because they don't want to appear that they've changed in response to public opinion. But the fact is they do change in response to public opinion. And I think that there are people who are kind of in the background who are trying to push for these things. And I've heard that, like, correlation, I think, used to be part of the hardliners, but I've heard that maybe they're not anymore, that some of the people there have been replaced, and that now we're getting a little bit more openness. And then from the Church History Department, who I think they did as much as they could with this essay, and I think there were some who wanted it to go farther than it did. But I'm a little bit encouraged by the essay, by the fact that it didn't say never. There was a footnote from Dallin Oaks that God has never ordained women. But it stopped short of saying that God never will allow the ordination of women. And so, I don't know. I saw it as kind of a mixed blessing. I was glad to see some of the historical stuff come out. Wish it had gone farther. But I think that there is something to build on for the future.
What you were saying just resonated with me so much, because it just hit me so hard just now. It's going to take a change in presidency.
Always.
It hit me. I was like, you know what? We have a younger generation. And if you look at the people who are coming in now, some of those folks just seem more open-minded to the certain culture of the time. And I just think about Elder Uchtdorf. He has blatantly said, you know, you look at the church history, we've made mistakes.
Yeah.
And I look at somebody like him, and when he goes up there and he gives his talks, and you can see that there's a certain level of empathy. I'm just using him as an example. I'm not saying he's the, you know, but it just occurred to me that when we sit there and we think, oh, is this ever going to happen? When is this going to happen? And it just occurred to me, sometimes it takes the right person in the right place to really get those things forward. And I think about President Hinckley and about just his conversations on polygamy sometimes, you know, and just even how he looked at it was so different than how it's often been talked about. And it just occurred to me that let us not give up hope, but
yeah,
just think about these things come with time and in the right way, in the ways that it needs to happen.
Right.
I mean, obviously with our part too, not just like, okay, let's not do anything about it. That's not at all what I'm saying. But I suspect that who is, as you said, the hardcore people versus people who are more open-minded will play out.
Yeah, and it takes too long, but it will change eventually. And last comment.
So the First Ordained Women Action was my sort of catalyst for my faith transition and my feminist awakening. I've spent a lot of time reading and researching and talking to people. And I guess my question is, do you think that female priesthood ordination is the beginning or the culmination of gender equality in the church?
Well, I guess for me, I think it's the beginning. What my vision, and I believe I can speak for the whole board, is that what we are seeking is opening it up so that anyone, any member who feels called to serve in an office that requires priesthood authority or power, that that person be ordained. I mean, I think we are shutting down so much of the power of the church by putting all of these little boxes and obstacles. And I also think that that will then change structures in the church and all of that. The nightmare for me would be if 38 years after we get women's ordination, you look around and the leadership with respect to the number of women participating looks like the leadership with respect to the number of black men participating. Exactly. That we cannot allow to happen again. Exactly. So we have to be working to change it on many different levels.
And our time is up. Toby, if you'll be really quick, I'll let you.
I'll be quick about it. I think if we could go back and look at the sequence of events that led up 1978, I think the Lord had to have a Spencer Kimball in place to do it. I don't think Harold B. Lee could have done it.
Harold B. Lee would not have done it.
A humble, truly, I think, dedicated prophet of the Lord is what did it.
Hopefully someday we'll have one who will
Thank you.
Break this logjam and do what needs to be done.